Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners. We're up to episode 20. That was Scott providing his usual consistent introduction. And in this case, doing it from a land far, far away, because he's actually on holidays. And without Scott, we have our regular fill-in, Paul. And welcome, Paul.
Hi, Trevor. How are you?
I'm very well. So we debated what we would call you. You've been the stand-in fist, and not, you know, maybe you're the stand-in velvet glove. Are you familiar with cricket at all, the sport of cricket?
I'm not really a cricket fan, to be honest.
Yeah, I didn't think you would be. But in cricket, if the fielding team, if a player has a problem, you know, they're a bit injured, tired, needs a toilet break or something like that, then there's the 12th man who comes in and fills in when necessary. So,
and Paul, is he a hard hitter, the 12th man?
What's that?
Is he a hard hitter?
He doesn't get to bat.
Oh, dear.
He just gets to field.
Oh, it doesn't sound very exciting.
Well, you've spotted the flaw in this already, Paul. You're quick. You're very quick. So, anyway, until I can think of a better term for you, rather than the Iron Fist or the Velvet Glove, we've got the Iron Fist and the 12th Man tonight, listeners. Okay. And Paul, no doubt, will do a sterling job. So, Paul, I've been away from the microphone for a week.
And having a good holiday, I believe.
Yeah, and problem is that I find this quite cathartic to get all this stuff off my chest. So we've got a lot to get through tonight.
Let's launch into it.
Yes. So first up, we've got the Australian Christian Lobby slamming a Safe Schools anti-bullying program. So we've basically got a program that's designed to be run in schools to help prevent bullying of lesbian, gay, transgender children. I mean, on the face of it, could anybody have a problem with such a program, Paul?
Oh, gee, Trevor, it's hard to fathom why those people would not want a program that would help kids to avoid misery at school.
So yes, folks, there is one group out there who's not happy with that program, and well, it's the Australian Christian Lobby. And
who else?
And they, of course, have marshalled their troops, and they have been bombarding politicians, basically saying that they don't want the program and it should be scrapped. And it's just another appalling example of the Christian faith meddling in things and stuffing up things for the rest of us.
It shows, Trevor, it shows their skewed priorities, doesn't it? Their priority is this, myth-based religion of theirs, this myth-based system that they think is a reliable guide to life on planet Earth in the 21st century. And it all stems from what people used to think was the right way to live, roughly a couple of thousand years ago.
Mm.
And yet they still seem to think it's relevant for us here in the 21st century.
Well, you know, in the whole length and breadth of the Bible, I think there's only the one reference to which is anti-homosexual in there, and yet they latch onto that.
Yeah.
And and ride that for all it's worth, and cause such misery for people. That's just none of their business. And this is
none of their business.
This is where I'm finding recently in my discussions with people that there's this notion of, you might be, that people aren't really against religion. They kind of think, oh, it's not for me, but it's pretty harmless stuff, and if other people want to do it, why not? And, you might let my kids go to Bible class. I mean, what harm could it be? Good for them to learn about other stuff.
And I find exactly the same thing, Trevor, when I speak to people. And people are often surprised that I become so passionate about religion, so passionately against religion, because, as you say, most people see it as basically a benign thing in society, and it's, you know, they have this, you know, this live and let live sort of notion, and they think, well, you know, I won't do anything to bother them, and they won't do anything to bother me. But that shows a very shallow understanding of what religion is and how it operates, I think.
Yeah, I think we need to get people more angry with religion over these sorts of issues. It's not providing moral guidance and good notions in the community. And this is a classic example of exactly the opposite. And they're so disingenuous. Like this program, you know, the website has a link to various other services, and some of those services talk about other things, but that's all in the links if people choose to follow them, and you know, it's all readily available via Google. And this Christian lobby has basically latched onto those, some of those things in these outside links that aren't taught in the program, and said, you know, this is teaching kids, you know, how to perform anal sex and how to bind their breasts. The program's doing nothing of the sort.
No, of course not.
They're so disingenuous about this sort of thing. And so yet another reason when people say, well, religion doesn't do much harm and on the whole does lots of good. Well, these are the sorts of, examples of things that it's doing bad stuff indeed. Out there.
Yeah, there's still the assumption, isn't there, that basically religion, all religions are basically sources of moral guidance, is the way I think the average person in the street sees most religion. As I said, a lot of people are very surprised and somewhat bemused by my passionate antipathy to religion. Look, I think it's part of the call to mission among, you know, dedicated followers of the Christian religion. You know, they feel it's their part of their life duty is to, you know, spread the faith, to perpetuate and foster the faith among the unbelievers, among the people who haven't yet found this precious gift that they think they have.
Yes, and I get that, and I understand that, and I'm probably, that all makes sense to me. I'm probably becoming more disappointed with the so-called secular side of the argument, where people are not, coming back against these people hard enough. I find people being a bit soft and wishy-washy in the face of, some of the terrible things they're doing. So that's going to be a bit of the theme of tonight, I think you'll find, Paul, as we run through these issues that actually religion's causing harm. But
I maintain that with pretty much everyone I speak to, is that religion isn't the benign force that people assume it is, and that it causes very definite harm. And look, I think, quite apart from the actual physical violence done by members of certain religions that we, easily come to mind in the Middle East. But look, for me, even the Christian religion, the main harm it does to our young people in particular is it plants faulty models in their brains. Human societies are all built on ideas, and we all need these sort of conceptual models in our mind of what reality is and how it operates in order to live in it and deal with, reality. And I think religion plants these faulty models of reality in the minds of children. And, they grow up not really being able to deal with reality adequately in some cases, because, they think things happen magically. And they just don't, as I think you'd agree with me, they just don't happen magically. Not in the, traditional sense of magically, in other words, defying the normal laws of nature and physics.
Yes, or that there's this greater power that's in charge, so why would you really try too hard yourself to change the world, because power's greater than you are at force and the world's going to end, or the revelation. It's not the revelation, it's Is it the Revelation when it comes, the coming of the God?
I couldn't tell you exactly where it is in the Bible, there was a report in the on the internet just recently, in the last few days, of some Christian parents in the United States not wanting to even send their kids to school or even homeschool them because they believed the second coming was nigh.
Yes, yeah. So there is that, but you know, the main one that gets me, Paul, is just the division it creates. You know, breaking children into groups at a very early age, and a classic example of that is occurring now, where in Victoria, we've previously reported that the Victorian government has basically wiped out these scripture lessons that were going on in public schools and forced them to do it either before or after school, which will effectively end that program. So not being allowed into the schools, the next move by Access Ministries is to move into preschools.
Yes, I did see that article. It was quite interesting, wasn't it? They're going for younger and younger targets.
Do you think
it's a sign that they feel they just have to get their foot in some sort of door of some sort of school at some level, and if that's the only one available, then in goes the foot?
I'm disappointed that we just didn't predict this earlier on. I mean, it's just what you'd expect, isn't it? They've been booted out of a regulated school environment, so now they're going into an unregulated kindergarten preschool environment. So this is an article here that we've listed on the website, where Access Ministries has moved into childcare centres and kindergartens, and the story is that they're teaching Christian values and beliefs in addition to stories from the Bible. And in this article, three families opted their children out of the program. Now, the interesting thing in that, Paul, is that they had to opt their children out because these people come in, they talk to the officials, they say, isn't it a great idea? Everybody should be doing this. And before you know it, you've got a situation where you've got to opt out to escape their clutches.
Yeah. The article also mentioned that the operators of the preschool claimed that enrolments had risen.
Yes.
As a result of having these Christian religion classes.
Yes. I find that hard to believe unless they're in some sort of crazy Bible Belt district. That's
a possibility, though, isn't it?
Yes. Or it's been heavily advertised in that area. In Brisbane, for example, out in the Pullenvale Brookfield way, you might have that happen. But I can't.
Oh, really?
Yeah, quite strong over there. But hard to imagine that in a general area. Anyway, the people from Thiris, who successfully lobbied to have kids out of the state school system, they've been active in this one now, and quoting from them, "We find it outrageous that kids as young as they are in childcare centres and kindergartens could be segregated by religion. We feel that's not a good start to a student's education life." Well, isn't that the truth?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, we just really got over the old Catholic-Protestant divide in Australia, didn't we, not so long ago?
Yes, yep. So,
but they're just teaching young kids to discriminate, aren't they, basically? They're teaching them that there are some kids amongst them, or perhaps later in life when they get to primary school or high school, they're teaching them that there are some kids that are not worthy of their friendship and their care and their affection.
That's right. I think it was Richard Dawkins I might have read, talking about a little girl who was abused by a priest, sexually abused. So that was one experience she had. But the other was that a Protestant friend of hers had died, another young girl, and she was told that her Protestant friend, because hadn't been baptized a Catholic, would burn in the fires of hell for all eternity.
Yes, indeed.
Now, her response, you know, as an adult, was that while being abused by the sexually abused was a yucky thing, she was far more traumatized by the thought that her friend was burning in hell for eternity. And that's what this group's teaching through their Bible studies to kindergarten children.
Absolutely horrific.
We're letting it happen. So, so there's a bit of child abuse happening. And on the topic of child abuse, Paul.
Yes.
I've always had a bit of a thing about Q&A.
Our friend from the United States.
I couldn't believe it. I go away for a week. Well, last time I went on holidays, Tony Abbott was rolled, and that was a bonus in my absence. And now I go away for another week, and somebody manages to get onto Q&A and manages to say that teaching, you know, indoctrinating children is child abuse. And I think that's fantastic. And good things happen when I go overseas, Paul. I'm going to have to keep going.
You should travel more often.
Yes. So, now, I briefly wanted to talk about Muslim children invited to lead the school assembly during the singing of the national anthem. A couple of issues on that one. One is that within the secular party, one of the members is part of an atheist group, and in there was a Pakistani Muslim or ex-Muslim who said that that's just a crazy notion that that Muslims during that period have to leave a room because they view an anthem as being a joyous event. Like, it was just complete nonsense to them. They'd never experienced that at all in their Islamic upbringing. So this
is something that's just been cooked up by some somewhat extreme Muslim group in our midst.
Yes, or perhaps cooked up by some school principal who's overly sensitive and looking for
ways to appease the Muslim community.
Yes, looking for ways to demonstrate supersensitivity, perhaps. I don't know the score there, but we had a bit of a discussion on this in an email group within the secular party, Paul, and even though you're a member of the party, you've never managed to get onto this secretive email group, have you?
No, I haven't, no. I'm on the outer.
We've tried several times, but you've never found it. But anyway, the interesting thing in that group was that a number of people said, well, singing the national anthem, very patriotic thing, you know, that's not very Australian. You know, I think it's probably a good idea that they were allowed to leave. And this is within a discussion group of the Secular Party of Australia. I had to butt into the argument and say, you know, you've got to be kidding. The main argument here is somebody being allowed to leave assembly on religious grounds.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, I don't think children should be forced to sing or say anything myself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you start exempting kids on religious grounds from school assembly, then where does it stop? You know, I mean, school assembly is a fairly benign event anyway. You know, it's usually just a matter of instilling a little bit of school consciousness, maybe school pride, maybe national pride, and I'm not a big one on patriotism at all, but I think for me the problem lies when that particular Muslim group that was mentioned in the article that you sent me, they were basically saying that they shouldn't be forced or bullied into accepting Australian values. Now, for goodness sake, we don't all have to agree on everything or like everything the same or even like each other, but we do, I think, as a community and as a country, we need to have some common values, you know. I mean, simple values like, non-violence, toleration of each other's differences and idiosyncrasies. But at the same time, we need some common values to keep civil peace, I think, in a country, don't you?
Look, I agree. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that anyone be forced to sing, because but they could certainly just sit there, and I mean, you can't force somebody to sing. You can't, you know. So
as many of us did.
Yeah, I mean, I there's plenty of times where I wouldn't have sung along to whatever hymns or songs are being done at an assembly. But Paul, you know, there was also a bit of this notion of, what would you say? Like, when you were at school, the idea that you might be in an assembly and think, well, I don't really like this particular section, I'll just absent myself for a few minutes and go wander around, come back when I feel like it, and I'll just chop and choose in the assembly bits here as to what's suitable for me and what I'm comfortable with. I mean, you would never, in your wildest of dreams, you know, just decided to walk out on the basis of you didn't like what was going on.
It undermines basic school discipline and authority. And, you know, I mean, I'm not an authoritarian or in favour of authoritarianism, even in a school setting. But obviously, to run a school, you need some basic discipline, some you know, and the children have to agree to, you know, basic discipline for their own safety, if for nothing else.
Look, it's a life skill to be able to sit in a meeting and suck it up if you don't like what's happening. I mean,
that's right.
It's of all the things that could be taught in a school week, that's probably one of the most vital lessons would be how to sit through something that you don't like because you have to. What better lesson could you learn?
There's also the idea that seems to be coming through is these people's God is the only authority that they recognise, and that, you know, the secular authorities, such as in the school, in the local and state and federal governments, are subordinate to their so-called God. You know, this sky fairy that I don't think you and I believe actually exists anywhere. And yet they're putting this phantom up as their supreme authority.
Yes.
Which is, I think, plainly dangerous, if not just deluded.
Yep. So, but you know what? So I'm saying, even if they had a good reason for not wanting to be there, too bad. Suck it up. That's part of life at a school. So
it is part of life. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
Next topic on the agenda. I'm really liking this Victorian government and some of the things that they're doing down there, Paul. Mm-hmm. They're really onto the equality issues. And unlike, well, I think Queensland perhaps, maybe one of the territories might be the same. Queensland has only a single house. So, but the other states do tend to have a lower and upper house. And unfortunately, the government down there doesn't have control of their upper house as well. So there's a campaign, there's a law going through, and I'll just read it, about adoption agencies. Basically, some religious groups are still involved in the adoption process, and they are wanting to be exempted from new laws which are allowing same-sex couples full adoption rights. So, religious groups are still involved in adoption business, and B, they think it's the Christian thing to do to deny an adoption to a same-sex couple.
Yeah, well, let's face it. It was the Christian groups that used to take newborn babies away from unwed mothers, despite those young mothers pleading and, you know, demanding that they be able to keep their babies. So no surprises there, really. And, you know, it's also historically true that religious groups think that everybody else's sex lives, reproductive lives are their business.
Yes.
So no real surprises.
I mean, we've been listening to this Royal Commission on Institutional Child Sexual Abuse and the horrific stories, and we're still listening to religious groups about how they think we should be dealing with kids.
That's right.
At what point do they just lose all credibility? But a couple of things from this article, Paul. There are only 30 stranger adoptions every year where the child is unknown to the couple.
Is that right?
Yes, this is in Victoria. And
interesting. I didn't know that.
Catholic Care, which is the name of the Catholic adoption agency, Catholic Care, how ironic is that? they were responsible for just 4 of them last year. The remaining 26 were conducted by 3 agencies, 2 of which are religious, but unopposed to the government's bill. So there are a couple of religious groups who are okay with it. It's just the Catholics.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm. Interesting.
Just despicable that they are involved in stopping that. So the Labor government down there is working hard, and they've got to try and organise things in the upper house, which is sort of split and difficult to get things through. Might be relying on votes from the Shooters and Fishers Party.
Oh, really?
Who knows what they're like?
So we won't see duck hunting banned in the next few years.
That might be the price to pay.
Poor ducks. The ducks will be sacrificed.
Yeah. So, God, imagine, Paul, in a world where perhaps the secular party had the balance of power. Wouldn't that be beautiful? There'd be no worries on this law then. But just on a little aside there, the Melbourne's Catholic Archbishop, Dennis Hart, has previously called on Parliament to protect the Catholic adoption service of 80 years. So good luck to
Because after all, look at all the good they've done.
Yes. I mean, that is what they will say. Look at all.
Oh, of course they will, yeah. I mean, they seem to be blind to their own ineptitude, their own, you know, inconsistency with their own messages of love and care and, you know, charity and, you know.
Yes. So the other issue that they're arguing over down there is religious bodies are able to discriminate against employees whose sexuality or religious beliefs conflict with the organisation's beliefs.
Yeah.
Now, previously there was a rule that it had to be relevant to their employment. So a gay gardener, you know, groundsman, couldn't be discriminated against. But that test was repealed by the previous government. So this current government is trying to reintroduce that sort of common sense.
So currently gay gardeners can be rejected.
Yes, in Victoria. So even though it's totally irrelevant to their employment.
Well, I suppose they would argue they can't have somebody on the grounds of the place who might send the wrong message to some of their constituents.
Yep. So, Paul, so here we've got the Shooters and the Fishers with a bit of power here. And I reckon that the Australian Christian lobby, what do you reckon they'd be doing?
Shooting and fishing.
Well, I reckon they would be firing off 1,000 emails to those couple of parliamentarians.
I think they'd be buying a shotgun and going out and mixing with them, wouldn't they?
Well, they would be doing that. You're right. They would be.
They would be. I reckon some of them would be already shooters and fishers anyway. So, I mean, let's face it. That would cover a fairly broad spectrum of people in the community anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not in the hunting and fishing community. You know, the traditional American view, you would think, would be of a right-wing conservative. And I don't know in Australia. I don't know. That'll be interesting. But
I think people who grew up in the country especially would have some experience with guns, anyway.
Yes.
And let's face it, fishing is a popular hobby through the community, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. I reckon there's some real down-to-earth people in that. It'd be interesting. But here's my point. What we should be doing is we should be writing emails like the Australian Christian Lobby saying, hey, there's a significant group of people out here who really want these laws changed. So For members of the Secular Party, Scott, we're putting out a newsletter in the next few days, and in that I've got a paragraph saying that we can have all the social media in the world, but we actually have to start writing emails and letters to politicians and power brokers, and I'm asking people to join a sort of an email action group type, where basically, if you agree, then when a topic comes up, we'll send you, you know, information about it, maybe a little draft letter, maybe some dot point arguments, and a list of email addresses, and we'd be saying, if you're on this list, then we want you to write a letter in your own words, preferably, and fire it off to your local member and your state education member or whoever's relevant to you to try and do this. So Secular Party members out there listening, it's an opt-in process, Scott, that I've got on this newsletter. If you want to be part of it, you have to click on something and opt in. So so I encourage people to do that, because this is the sort of topic that we should be active in sending a message to counter what the Australian Christian lobby is up to.
Yes, indeed.
I agree. Now, did you get the newsletter? I know you hardly... You're in this sort of black hole of communication.
I'm in a black hole, yes. No, I didn't get the newsletter. I'm not sure why.
You didn't get the newsletter? You've never received a newsletter from the Secular Party?
I've never received it, no.
We've got to do something. I don't know what... You are in a black hole of communication. I don't know what's going on there. Perhaps, Paul, we could ask Jesus Christ. That is, of course, if he ever existed. Yeah. Did he ever exist?
Look, I don't believe he did, frankly, and I suspect you're of the same mind. And, you know, I've had an interest in... things religious since I was at university about, you know, how many years ago? 25 or so years ago I was at university, and I read quite a lot about religion written by, you know, some of the classic anthropological and sociological studies of religion. I haven't read them all, but I've read enough of them to know where I stand on the topic. And look, I hadn't read a lot about the historical Jesus at that time, but I've come across material since then. And I think the evidence for the historical Jesus is pretty thin on the ground, I have to say. And look, interestingly, I saw a doco about the creation of the Islamic religion by an English historian, is it Tom Holland or someone like that? And he also suggested that there was not a lot of evidence for the historical Muhammad, which I thought was interesting, because everyone goes around saying, oh, well, of course, you know, Muhammad was so recent and we have so much stuff about him. And
yeah.
But apparently not.
Wow, okay. So... I wasn't aware of that, but I certainly was aware of sort of the doubts about the existence of Jesus Christ.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Oh, you might recall many, many episodes ago, Steve Austin, ABC Radio Brisbane, did an interview with a guy who was a theologian and had done a study of the Bible and blah, blah, blah. And in that time I said, you know, he's just going on about these things about what Christ did, rah, rah. And, you know, Christ quite possibly never existed, but that topic never came up in their discussion. But there's an article, folks, that I've linked to, and it's a study by a guy called Porkovich, who says that only one of the 126 texts he combed through contains any mention of Jesus, and that, he says, is a forgery.
Yes, indeed.
And it's, you know, it's quite easy to tell forgeries in certain circumstances, depending on what they've done. So,
well, the text scholars can pick up forgeries by the style of the writing and the context, and whether it seems to, you know, fit in with what's around it. And and apparently, yes, that's exactly what they say, is that those mentions of Jesus were a later addition, probably by, you know, biblical scholars of the Roman Church at the time.
Yes, and they've done similar things with sections of the Bible. I think maybe some of Paul's letters were clearly written by somebody else. So, so yeah, just by general style, I can tell whether something's a forgery. So, I mean, I had a...
What about Jesus in the desert? Alone in the desert?
Yes.
And somebody was there writing down what he was doing and saying, but I don't know who that was, do you?
No, what are you referring to? Or were you...
You know, when Jesus went off into the desert alone to, you know... search his soul over something. And, you know, the Satan was talking to him and he was, you know, having a conversation, resisting the temptations and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And apparently somebody was following him around, writing this all down.
Had to have been. Unless, of course, he told them afterwards, perhaps.
Yeah, right.
Through some revelation. But, but you know, I had a recent trip through parts of Europe and... It's amazing what records there are of ancient history. And here we've got basically the Son of God and God himself landing on Earth and presumably, you know, pulling off some remarkable feats. And not a single word is written about him, despite the fact that there being lots of chroniclers and poets and recorders of all sorts. Yeah. Not a single contemporaneous word about him.
That's right. It doesn't instill much confidence, does it?
No. So first parts of the Bible, I think, are thought to have been written sort of 70 to 90 years after his death, if he ever died.
Oh, the New Testament,
So, so... There's one to trot out for people at a dinner party when the talk goes to religion. Just
I regularly trot that one out, actually, and people are incredulous. They look at you as if you've lost your marbles completely. You know, they say, "What? What do you mean? Of course Jesus existed. Everybody knows that, you know. But obviously, you know, there's people have these huge assumptions that because." You know, because it's been a cornerstone of belief for so long, then it absolutely must be true. You know, it's the old idea that, you know, if millions of people believe something to be true, it must be true. But it's, of course, obviously not necessarily true.
Correct, yeah. So so that's one for the young folk to trot out at a dinner party, if they do dinner parties anymore, Paul. I mean, you were quick to let loose that you do attend dinner parties still. But
oh, I don't attend too many dinner parties, but whenever I do get the chance, I'm happy to broach the subject if anyone's interested.
Maybe that's why you don't get that many invitations, Paul.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
Okay, I'm going to divert away from religion just a moment to the second of my hobby horses, which at the moment is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You've been listening carefully to my words of wisdom on this topic, Paul?
On the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yes.
I'm not sure if I have.
Okay.
But, look, I have taken an interest, not a detailed interest.
Yes.
But, yeah, I've been all along a little bit concerned that it was basically an instrument for the to further the interests of large corporations rather than the actual citizens of any particular country.
Well, you've probably know as much as you need to know, Paul, with that. I mean, you're spot on. That would be the major purpose of it. And it's an evil document, Paul, and there's no way we should be signing it. And I've previously talked about these investor-state dispute settlement clauses.
Yes, that's a worry, isn't it?
And we said, you know, weren't sure if it was going to be in this, but if it is, we need to avoid it. And folks, the answer is that sort of clause is in this document, and therefore we need to... You can't amend this document. You either take it wholly as it is or not at all. Mm-hmm. So it's not about amending it. So on that basis alone, we should not sign it. And Andrew Robb will say, well, look, I've specifically exempted the tobacco packaging stuff from that clause. And, well, that's all very well, but there's a myriad of other reasons you could be sued under that clause. A lot of them environmental sort of issues where...
That's right, yeah.
Governments want to make environmental decisions and multinationals who've got business ideas in that direction... want to take action against the government. And he would say that within the TPP is a clause that basically protects governments. But the short answer is it doesn't. And I've got a link to an article, and there's a fellow here called, well, he's American, obviously, because his name is George Kahale III. Australians, have you ever heard of an Australian called the Third? I always think of...
No, I've never met one. Have you?
The one I always think of is Thurston Howell III from Gilligan's Island. But it seems to be an American thing that, you know, you'll be the third. So I'm assuming he's American. And he's an expert in a legal arbitration firm and acts for governments who have been sued. And he is saying that the Trade Minister is wrong. And basically because it's got an exemption in there which just doesn't work the way it's worded. And there's another interesting thing that he came out with, which really interested me, was that this agreement has a most favoured nation clause, which means that the parties to this agreement, say between Australia and the US, if the US could find another trade agreement that we have with somebody else, like India or China or something, and the provisions in that are more favourable to the foreign company, then the Americans would automatically gain those more favourable conditions.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
So there's this most favoured nation status that the parties to this Trans-Pacific Partnership are guaranteed the best deal on all issues possible.
So, wow, that's an interesting detail. The other thing you may have come across, Trevor, is just recently the Prime Minister of Japan, apparently, when talking to some group, said that the TPP was written by and for the United States and Japan. Did you come across that?
No, I didn't. But
he was basically saying that now the United States and Japan make the rules, and they're the ones who are going to be the biggest beneficiaries.
Given that they've got large multinational corporations, that makes sense.
Yes,
but
yes, it does.
Just getting back to this most favoured nation status, so not only does it mean that, you know, if we're quantities of wheat or barley or whatever else or we're doing with some other country, then America gets that great deal. But if we've got an investor-state dispute clause with some other country in some other agreement that's better than the one in the TPP, then the Americans
then
could use that as well.
So
the American companies under the TPP could use the same clause that Philip Morris is using
to sue the Australian government.
Yes, because of the most favoured nation status. So,
and as we know, that's complete undermining of our, you know, our democracy, of our right as citizens to elect a government to make laws of our choosing. And then a foreign corporation comes in and says, well, that's all very well, but we don't like it, so you're going to have to change it.
Plus, you know, when they take on a country, it goes to a court of arbitration, which is not a proper court.
Not a proper legal court.
No, these are not heard
representatives,
they're not heard in courts probably staffed by independent judges. They're heard in hotel rooms with arbitrators handpicked by the parties. There's no referring to precedent. Then
it's hardly transparent.
They're not open to appeal. And these arbitrators can be severely conflicted because they might act as a judge one day and a lawyer for a party the next. The guy you're trying to argue with could well be on the payroll of the multinational in another case.
That's right.
And we're prepared to accept that.
We're prepared to expose ourselves to that.
Yes. So it's all right for... You've got a dog out there. Well, that'll come through. Yes. We've got a dog in the background, and I know last week we had the sound of rain falling on the tin roof as well. So
it makes the whole thing a bit more rustic and down home.
You know, I think that dog is not happy with the TPP either. And
he's clearly not. I've told him about it.
Yeah. Actually, as I was researching this, I Googled TPP Most Favoured Nation status, and I came across, like, there wasn't a lot on it, very little on it. And but I did come across a law firm website of Clayton Utz, which is a well-known big law firm, and basically advising its clients that the TPP's got a most favoured nation status clause in there, and that's going to give you lots of opportunities to take advantage of. Give us a call, is what it's what the link is saying. So
it's a wonder they don't have billboards floating in, you know, above the sky of each country.
Yeah. So Paul, are you a bigot? Well, maybe
Are
you a bigot? Because
a bigot.
Yes.
I don't think so, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me if some people thought I were, simply because I you know, I don't follow the usual politically correct nonsense about not criticizing religions. You know, I mean, apparently that makes you automatically a bigot these days, according to some.
Well, according to George Brandis, our Attorney General, our former Prime Minister Tony Abbott was the subject of bigotry at its most shameful. Paul?
Yes, I did read that. That was talk about hyperbole.
I think I am guilty of this. The incessant smearing ridicule of the former Prime Minister, Mr. Abbott, on account of his religious faith was bigotry at its most shameful.
At its most shameful.
Made worse, if that is possible, by the added hypocrisy of the fact that many of those very same people like to pose as the enemies of bigotry, he said. It's our Attorney General,
George Brandis. Look, George Brandis has been a big disappointment to me because, you know, when they were elected, he seemed to be heading towards amending Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. And I, for one, thought that was a good move because, you know, as you know, I'm an advocate of complete free speech. And I don't agree with the notion that that makes bigotry, that encourages bigotry or makes bigotry any more of a problem to anyone. I just think we need more conversation, not less conversation, about controversial topics, and, you know, including things that people think are hurtful or harmful to them and their interests. You know, I mean, the case of Andrew Bolt being convicted under that section, I think was a black mark on our free speech life here in Australia myself. And it's not that I am a particular admirer of Andrew Bolt at all. In fact, I find him quite often quite abhorrent. But at the same time, I think he has a right to express his views.
I agree. I don't like 18C, and I don't like the sort of relevant Queensland section that's very similar. Far too broad in their approach. And put that on hold for a minute, that thought, because we're going to talk about those billboards, and we'll talk about 18C in relation to those. But just going quickly back to George Brandis, he also said, one could be forgiven for being fearful for religious freedom, claiming members of the Muslim faith were the victims of ignorance, suspicion, and hostility. So I just made a note there that I'm not fearful for religious freedom, I'm fearful of religious freedom.
Yes, indeed. It seems to me that so-called religious freedom is being given domain over non-religious people.
Yes, Yep, this word freedom and religion, the two words are being put together a lot lately.
And there's a lot of irony there too, when if he claims that people who follow and promote any religion that's so full of ignorance and bigotry and racism that they are themselves the victims. Mm. It's just amazing. Mm.
So he actually, I think he was speaking at the Religious Freedom Roundtable, which our Vice President Ian Bryce was attending under his hat of the humanist President of New South Wales. So I'm interested to see what happened at this round table. But Senator Brandis told the round table there was a need to tackle the alarming emergence of intolerance of religious faith by some of the most voluble elements in the community and promote a spirit of tolerance. Because you see, you know, religion and Catholics are under attack, apparently. Paul. But he also quotes in there Justice Hayden, who at the Acton lecture last year said Catholicism in Australia now might be called the racism of the intellectuals. Now, we've talked about Dyson Hayden before on two fronts. So he's the guy who agreed to attend a Liberal fundraiser while investigating Labor figures in a Royal Commission.
Yes.
And he also questioned Julia Gillard as a witness because she was so well prepared. So I'm a bit shaky about Dyson Hayden. And then I've quickly looked up. This is the beauty of the internet, isn't it, Paul? Like, you can look up things. You can, well, what happened in the Acton lecture? And here it is. This is what he had to say. High Court Judge, this new anti-Catholicism may backfire as much as Bismarck's Kulturkampf. It is intolerant. Huh? It is hypocritical. It fails to recognise the extraordinary contribution of Australian Catholicism to education, to charitable relief, to the running of hospitals, to social progress of all kinds,
to the nurturing of children,
to political life, and indeed to the life of the nation as a whole.
Oh,
without that contribution, Australia would not be the Australia we know. The new anti-Catholicism may cause suffering, but it is suffering which may unify Catholics. This is Dyson Hayden. These are people in charge of things.
I know. And I think I mentioned to you in a correspondence that it always surprises me when, you know, such... in every other way, such intelligent, well-educated people still don't see through the bogus nature of religion in general. I mean, do these people study history? Have they ever opened a basic anthropology book? I don't know. But I mean, obviously, human psychology is very complex, and I think people basically believe what they want to believe, regardless of whatever evidence is staring them in the face. But it's disappointing when the leaders of our community and the people with power in our community actually rail against the people like us who want, you know, our society to progress in a gentle, constructive way that is good, that is nurturing, that, you know, that is healthy for people and not something that divides the community along religious or whatever lines. And we are then set up as the bigots, you know, as the people who want to divide the community and, you know, destroy religion. I mean, well, we might want to destroy religion, but that's, I mean, obviously in the secular party, that's not one of our platforms at all. We promote tolerance of everybody to believe what they want to believe, so long as it does no harm.
Yes.
And that's the
that's
the cornerstone of it, isn't it? Really?
And I think we need to, you know, increasingly make people aware of the harm that is being caused in many respects.
I absolutely agree, Tom.
Yeah. So
and I try to make a point of it on a regular basis on my Facebook page to those, you know, handful of people who actually look at it. But in your day-to-day dealings, I don't know about you, Trevor, but in my day-to-day dealings with work colleagues and just anybody I meet, I don't you know, I don't look for every opportunity to raise the topic of religion, but if it does come up, I'm more than happy to talk about
yes.
it with anybody.
Yes.
And I make it fairly clear to them quite often that I think religion does do real harm, and it's not the benign force that people have so long assumed it to be.
Good on you, Paul. Between you and me and the velvet glove, you know, one person at a time will convert this country.
Yeah.
But
somebody has to make a front.
Indeed. Now, back to this Religious Freedom Roundtable. I did find an article in The Guardian with a bit of a report from it. So the Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, said the challenge of respecting religious freedom is becoming more complex.
Mm.
And I would argue that it's actually getting easier. And that would be because the religious are just getting more nuttier by the day. So so it's making it easier to sort of... It's a simple situation. It's not so complex. But apparently at the round table, there were the Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Catholic, Anglican, Baha'i, Russian Orthodox and Buddhist faiths. Yeah. And also representatives from the Seventh-day Adventists, the Rationalist Society, the Humanist Society, the Atheist Foundation, and the Church of Scientology.
Wow.
Like, I think I said I can't imagine the Church of Scientology will get a run, but they're there. Mm.
Yeah.
This is the group, Paul, who the High Court said are a complete sham of a religion.
Did our High Court
yes.
say that? That's interesting. I wasn't aware of
the
that.
The High Court said it's a complete sham. The yeah. rituals that have been created have been done purposefully so as to
yeah.
look like a religion, so as to get a tax yeah. exemption.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, the Victorian Full Supreme Court said all of that as well, and the Supreme Court said, therefore, you're not a religion and you don't get tax benefits. But the High Court...
Is that right?
Yes, but the High Court said... All of that's true. It's a complete sham. You've done this in this manner to purely to as a front to appear to be a religion, but
yep.
you've been successful enough that people actually believe you, and therefore that's good enough. You are a religion.
Oh, my God. Really? So they retained their tax-free status?
Correct. Now, our gosh. Own High Court has said that, and yet... They get a seat at the Religious Freedom Roundtable.
Yeah, well, look, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all a bunch of deluded people. So, I mean, they're in good company, aren't they?
Well, really? Except for the Rationalist Society, the Humanist Society and the Atheist Foundation.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to inject some sanity into the proceedings. But I'm assuming, Trevor, like me, you have read a little bit about the history of the Church of Scientology. And you'd be as aware as I am that the founder, L. Ron Hubbard, was the biggest con man out.
Yeah.
He was a complete fraud. And he's been quoted as saying to one of his colleagues when he was creating the Church of Scientology, yeah. he was quoted as saying, "Let's sell these people a piece of blue sky."
Yes.
Now, that was what he's quoted as saying. It's a famous reference,
yeah.
isn't it? And there was an English former Scientology member who wrote a book about it, and that was the title of his book.
Yes.
And I've read it, or I've read most of it, and he, you know, he comes out and says, "Look, it is just a money-making enterprise, and you know, they do have those trappings of religious ritual, but it's just for making money, and it's just for conning people into giving them
yes,
money."
Yes, yes, a bit like the Mormon Church. I mean, the guy who started that was a convicted con man as well. So
he was indeed. Yeah, I've read a little about him as
so
well.
So it doesn't look like the Mormons got a run in this, but I'd rather have seen them there than the Church of Scientology, I think. So
oh, look, you know, who really cares
yeah.
who's there? Because I mean, they're all followers of fantasy and delusion, as far as I'm concerned. Except for the atheists, the rationalists, and the humanists, of course.
Yeah. So, a bit of a quote from Tim Wilson. He says, "The purpose of the roundtable is to get beyond past approaches and find a way to ensure religious freedom of those with or without belief is respected in a truly pluralist society. Now, I wasn't sure of the definition of pluralist, but I looked it up, and it's basically where people believe different things and tolerate each other's beliefs, even when they don't match their own. And the operative word is tolerate. Like, that's what we're missing in this whole religious freedom debate. It should be about religions tolerating different beliefs and rather than insisting that their own is foisted on people.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, what they're really after is religious privilege, not religious tolerance.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. He says some good things occasionally, as Tim Wilson. He said taxpayer funding for religious institutions needs to be part of the discussion. So I'm surprised he said that. I don't know. I haven't got a handle on this Tim Wilson yet, because the other thing is he, you know, is a Hillsong devotee.
Yes, I wasn't aware of that at all. And look, I've been a bit of an admirer of Tim Wilson on his free speech cause, because he has been a very strong advocate for free speech, and I've admired him, and he's quite an articulate speaker as well. And he's obviously very bright. And so I was quite taken aback when it was suggested to me that he was a member of the Hillsong Church. I never would have guessed, I have to say.
Yeah, well, he was also, you know, an employee and spokesperson for the Institute of Public Affairs. And when the plain packaging tobacco laws were coming out, he, on behalf of that group, was on the radio interviews and television, did about 13 interviews in one day, saying it was outrageous. Yet never in any of those interviews was it disclosed that the Institute of Public Affairs was funded by big tobacco companies.
Yes, yes. Now, what was the basis of it being outrageous? That it was a violation of their intellectual property? Was it along those lines?
I don't know the argument he ran. I mean, he's a smart guy. Probably ran lots of arguments. I don't know what he ran, but...
he is a smart guy, no doubt about it.
You know, I can accept that lawyers are a bit of a gun for hire, that when you hear a lawyer speak on a matter, of course he's going to say stuff for the plaintiff or the defendant. He's paid to.
Yeah.
But everybody knows that. And so they understand that a lawyer can one day say X and then the following week try the alternative argument because he's employed by somebody different in a different case. But, you know, these right-wing think tanks that have these names like Institute of Public Affairs, I mean, they sound like independent research groups that are just analysing data and helping us all out.
And, of course, they're not. They have interests and they have agendas to push, quite a lot of them. Look, I don't necessarily think they're all bad for us, obviously. We need a range of views and a range of perspectives. And look, there is the case of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who when she approached some more sort of left-leaning liberal think tanks in the United States, they didn't seem very interested. And she was actually embraced by a fairly conservative think tank in the United States. And they provided her with a job and some sort of sponsorship, I believe, so that she could actually move permanently to the United States.
Right. So, well,
I guess we can't say they're completely bad or
we
don't do some sort of public service in some respect. But I think scrutiny is what they all require, Trevor. As long as we have people who are scrutinizing all these think tanks and everybody, in fact. I mean, it goes back to the old critical thinking idea that, you know, everything should be scrutinized and critically examined for whatever it's worth.
You need to know if people are in the paid employ of other groups. Like, at least with the Australian Christian Lobby, we know they are there to push the barrow of Christians. Okay, that's their job. the secular party, people know we're pushing the secular line. We're biased in that view. Yeah. So when you hear something from us, bear that in mind. But when you get these sort of think tank groups and people don't know that their role, it's very dangerous that they might be employed by or paid by a certain industry group and are running a line that that industry group wants because they're being paid to.
Well, are they not obliged to disclose funding?
Well, they don't. I mean, I've got links here on the website where this Institute of Public Affairs was had a regular Friday morning time slot with an ABC radio presenter and and never, it seems, in particular this tobacco issue, disclosed the funding. So, you know, sort of put forward as independent, and in the end, if you're being paid lots of money by somebody, then you're not so independent.
No, not really.
So so that was Tim Wilson, and actually there's one other thing he said. It's good that we have religious institutions providing schools in a more cost-effective way than sometimes the government can do. And if that's consistent with people's private faith, and if that's what they wish, then so be it. I mean...
There's so much wrong with that.
Religious institutions providing schools in a more cost-effective way? Give me a break.
So it's all about cost. It's not about quality of the education of our
children. It's not even true.
It's about cost. And look, it comes back, doesn't it, Trevor, to this this notion that seems to be current with some people that a country is an economy and that citizens are just economic units.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, but it's not even true. They don't do it more cost-effectively. They take money from the government.
No, I agree. They don't. And that line has been pushed long and hard, hasn't it, by the conservative side of politics.
I mean, they take money from the government and they don't take struggling kids and kids with problems.
No,
so it's really easy or much easier to run a school when you're not dealing with the disadvantaged. So you are at a big advantage. So it's totally wrong to say... They do it in a more cost-effective manner. So
that's right. And if it's a religious school that draws from a very specific religious community, then they pretty much know that the parents, on the whole, are going to be on side with whatever they decide to do.
So,
because, you know, they've got this, you know, this so-called religious authority. And so, you know, they're looked up to. They're seen as the moral guides for the community.
Yes. Well,
and most people would be unwilling to challenge
them. Yes, I'm tempted to go a few different directions, but I'm just moral guidance. Let's go on with it. I mean, there's an article here about the Bible, and basically the heading of the article is Christians hardly read the Bible themselves. Why do they try so hard to force it on others?
It's a funny one, isn't it?
It's true.
But let's face it, you know, these prominent evangelists that we see from time to time on television, the way they speak, it's apparent to me that they just make it up as they go along. You know, Jesus said this, Jesus said that, Jesus did this and didn't do that. I reckon they just make it up as they go along, Trevor. I really do.
Of course they do, and people just swallow it for all sorts of psychological reasons, don't they? But
indeed, psychological is, I think, you've hit the nail on
in, in this article. This guy you know, was a lecturer of some sort in a religious class, and he would ask people at the start, you know, how many of you fervently believe that the Bible is the word of God? And of course 90% of the attendees would put their hand up, and then he would say, now how many of you read the Bible every day? And it was only a small proportion, 20%. And he's like, well, if you really believe this is the word of God,
the creator of the universe, after all, wouldn't you want to read
to read it every day? But
no,
so he sort of makes that point about, if you really believe that, surely you would, you know, you've read Harry Potter, the entire thing, but you haven't read the entire Bible. And, you know, of course, anybody who has read the Bible would understand it's a lot easier to support the God of the Bible if you don't actually read it, because if you do start reading it, it's a terrible document.
Yeah.
But Looking at this, Paul, one of the things he said is that 60% of Americans can't name even 5 of the 10 commandments.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I took note of
you
that.
Did?
And look, I have to admit, I can't either unless I look them up. But when
no,
you do,
no, I want to test
them,
you.
I'm
no,
sure
I've got it,
it
here, Paul. This is my test for you, because
yeah,
give it a crack. The Ten Commandments. How many can you get?
I've got them right in
front
of me.
Oh, you're cheating. Okay,
but,
you've got.
Sorry, I'm
you're cheating. Then if you're going
to. But look, the only ones that make any sense to me, I have to say, don't kill.
Yes.
Don't steal.
Yes.
Well, those two, basically. Don't kill, don't steal. I mean,
well,
maybe respect your parents is a nice
yes.
one. The rest are rubbish. The rest are about this vain, egotistical psychopath who demands not only undying love and devotion and obedience, but, threatens... You know, hell.
That's right.
Literally. To burn in hell forever for those who don't, accede to his demands. The creator of the universe...
I hope it's not true.
The creator of the universe, Trevor, is so obsessed with the attention of Homo sapiens on this puny little speck of dust called planet Earth. I mean, it's just bizarre, isn't it, that the creator of this massive universe would be so interested in us and our sex lives, for goodness
and
sake.
And he's so vain, because the first four commandments,
he's so
number
vain.
One, I am the Lord your God. Number two, thou shalt bring no false idols before me.
I know, it's
number
bizarre,
three,
isn't it?
Do not take the name of the Lord in vain. And number four, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. So, you know... People say, where would we be without the Ten Commandments for moral guidance?
Yeah,
yet the first four of them are about a vain God wanting attention.
Well, it sounds like the work of a psychopath, doesn't it? An extremely vain psychopath.
Yes. So so I thought that was interesting. Oh, that's a shame you had that in front of you. I've prepared you to... See, what I would do with Scott in this situation is I would never have even sent him the link to the original article, and then I would just test him on the... On the commandments. So he's always at a disadvantage. Yeah. So I'll have to be cleverer with you in future, Paul.
Yeah, you can try. Have you ever looked up the alternative Ten Commandments? Because some of our secular friends around the world have come up with some. Have you looked at any of them?
You know, I've heard of it, and but
can I read you a
Paul,
few? I have one right in front of me.
How could somebody possibly come up with a moral code or guide if they're not relying on the word of God? How could you in such a vacuum begin to construct an ethical framework? I mean, go on, Paul. Give me the best ones.
Okay. Anyway, first one, do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you.
Now, some people would say that comes from the Bible,
but it's not. It comes from human societies all around
Indeed,
the world.
Indeed, and there's evidence of it, I think, from Confucius, who was like 500 years before Christ. So, but that's a classic thing where people would say that's from the Bible, and it dates from much earlier
people
times.
People refer to it as the golden rule, don't they, basically. How about the second one? In all things, strive to cause no harm.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Third one. Treat your fellow human beings, your fellow living things, and the world in general with love, honesty, faithfulness, and respect.
Can we go back to the second one?
Yeah.
In all things, try to cause no harm.
Strive to cause no harm.
I'm really trying to cause harm to religion, Paul.
But that's not actual harm. That is, you're trying to...
It's not physical.
...disabuse people of these silly ideas is all you're trying to do. So I would argue, Trevor, you're actually trying to...
I'm trying to help the individuals, but the actual organisation, I'm trying to cause harm.
Yeah, but you're not inciting murder.
Look, I never claim to be perfect.
Like
sorry, keep going. I'll just check that I can comply with all these.
All right. Do you want to hear some more?
Yes.
The fourth one, do not overlook evil or shrink from administering justice. but always be ready to forgive wrongdoing freely admitted and honestly regretted.
That's very good. I like that. And I like the first part because I think my nickname of the Iron Fist works well with that. And the other one about apologies, could we refer our Aboriginal friends to that one? Because I've often said, how about accepting the apology? So, okay, I'm good with all that.
Okay, the fifth one, live life with a sense of joy and wonder.
Am I allowed to covet my neighbour's wife in the ones coming up?
In this new set, yes, you're definitely allowed to covet your neighbour's wife. Sixth commandment, always seek to be learning something new. It's very modern.
We're definitely doing that here on the Iron Fist Velvet podcast.
Number seven, test all things. Always check your ideas against the facts and be ready to discard even a cherished belief if it does not conform to them.
Test all things. I just tried to test you. I'm up for that one. That's good. Yep.
Okay, good. Number eight, never seek to censor or cut yourself off from dissent. Always respect the right of others to disagree with you.
Very good.
Gee, if only some of our religious friends would embrace that one.
These are very good.
Number nine, form independent opinions on the basis of your own reason and experience. Yes. Do not allow yourself to be led blindly by others.
That's good.
Hear. Yeah. And number 10, question everything.
And they've come up with that independently without reference to some sort of holy book. That's amazing.
Without reference to any holy book, as far as I can tell. But I'll tell you, the website I got it from is patheos.com.
Yes. Lots of good stuff on there.
Yes.
Yeah. The whole idea of an independently worked out code of ethics. I was watching some sort of Richard Dawkins video, and he was talking about these holy books and saying, well, there's obviously lots of terrible stuff in there, and there's some occasional good bits. And religious people cherry pick the good bits
and
ignore the bad bits. And how do they do that? By reference to what they know is good and bad from their figurings outside of the Bible or these books. I mean, because they have to. And he's saying, why do you even bother with the Bible if you've got to refer to a different set of values in order to cherry pick the bits of the Bible you're going to take? Yeah. I mean, why deal with it? So, very good argument, I thought, as always, with that sort of stuff that he comes out with. So that was good. I like that, the Ten Commandments and the...
Sometimes religious people, you know, say to you, you've probably had this said to you, Trevor, as I have, that, you know, without reference to some religious belief, how could you possibly be a moral person? Why don't you go out and murder and rape and pillage as much as you like? And I saw an interesting response to that on the internet, on Facebook, in fact. And one guy said, do you know what I say to people when they say, why don't I go out and why am I not out murdering and raping as much as I like? And he says, I am.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. Yeah.
It's simple, but it's real, isn't it? I mean, obviously, we don't want to go out and rape and murder, and we're not. And it's not because we're afraid of burning in hell or anything like that. We just don't want to do it. It doesn't strike us as something we want to do.
Yep, that's true. So, so people are interested in reading a bit about the Bible, and they can't stomach the thought of reading the original. I've got a link to an atheist guide to the Bible, and there's a little excerpt from the Book of Leviticus. Love the name Leviticus. It just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? And just gives you a sort of a more plain English version of what's going on here. Goes on to different sections. One heading, comic relief. We're given a story to break up the piling on of rules. A half Egyptian boy is going around camp cursing and blaspheming God's name. They bring the troubled lad to Moses, who locks him up until he hears from God. Soon enough, God decides to have the foul-mouthed kid stoned to death by the entire congregation. That's in the book of Leviticus. And also in there... Yeah. Now, here's another quiz for you, Paul. Monetary value for human beings in shekels of silver. If I've got a male aged between 20 and 60, how much do you reckon... how many shekels?
I'd probably give you 25 shekels.
Close.
For a decent
50
amount.
Was the going rate, according to...
50 shekels?
According to the book of Leviticus.
Was that a slave?
Yes, must be. And so if a man was worth 50 shekels, how much was a woman worth?
Well, about 5, I guess.
You know it's going to be less, don't you? So, women max out at 30 shekels. So, you know, and there's some...
And that would be a very, you know, prime, nice-looking one in prime childbearing
no
age.
No doubt. And there's formulas in there for other ages. You know, if you happen to have a male, a teenage years, you could look that up and because you wouldn't want to pay too much for your slave. So that's good in Leviticus. No. So that's a little book you can refer to if you're looking for a bit more on the Bible. Now, we're going way over time with this, Paul, but I'm enjoying myself so much because I needed to get all this off my chest having a week off. So
yeah, it's been a while.
So bear with us, folks. You know, we're going hardcore in a long episode this time, but...
We're not the ABC. We're not limited to a time slot.
You know, if you don't like it out there, listener, go onto our website or our Facebook page and say so. Like, just any feedback.
Tell us what you think.
Any feedback at all, positive or negative. A bit like, was it the Ninth Commandment you mentioned before or something? I'm encouraging people to criticise if they wish about the length of this episode. But... originally cut it down to 60 because my wife told me to, Paul, and I've since discovered she probably hasn't listened to the last 10 episodes, so I figure... I figure...
So even if we go overtime, she probably won't notice.
She probably won't. So, now, next topic, offensive billboards, Paul. So we've got Sam Harris, who... American author/atheist coming to Australia, and the organisation that was inviting him and looking to promote him had the idea of putting up some provocative billboards to get attention. And so we're going to read out a couple of them. So one billboard was going to have, "We are now in the 21st century. All books, including the Quran, should be fair game for flushing down the toilet without fear of violent reprisal." That was one. Another one was, "Jesus Christ, who, as it turns out, was born of a virgin, cheated death, and rose bodily into the heavens, can now be eaten in the form of a cracker." So, that was good, I thought.
And where's the offense?
Well, what's happened, folks, is that the company in charge of the who owns the advertising, APN Outdoor, rejected the ads due to their code of ethics, which states that ads cannot include material that vilifies religion.
Yeah, and which religion has been vilified exactly?
Well, good question. So, I don't think that there's vilification, because it's simply, the first one says, you should be able to flush the Quran down the toilet without fear of violent reprisal. The second one, well...
Which I think a lot of most reasonable people would say, yes, you should, wouldn't they?
I would have thought so. But it's interesting, the code of ethics says they cannot include material that vilifies religion. So I think you and I would agree that those do not vilify religion. But Paul,
not at all.
If we go back to 18C and some other legislation, so for example, in Queensland we have The Anti-Discrimination Act in Queensland says a person must not, by public act, incite hatred towards, serious contempt for, or severe ridicule of a person or group of persons on the grounds of race, religion, sexuality. It would be arguable that the public act of putting up that billboard could incite severe ridicule?
Well, I suppose talking about Jesus being eaten as a cracker does come across as ridicule. I suppose in some way it is, but it certainly wouldn't be inciting any form of physical violence against any particular individual or group.
Agreed. And that's the important part. So I would argue that Section 124 of the Anti-Discrimination Act is way too broad. I mean, yes. Sure, we don't want to incite hatred and violence, but no. Really? We can't ridicule a group?
Yeah. Look, yeah, and, you know, if you know anything about Sam Harris, and I'm sure you do, Sam Harris is one of the most reasonable and articulate public intellectuals out there, and he repeatedly says, you know, he does not advocate violence. He does not want any particular religious people harmed. Mm. He just wants them to wake up and re-examine their beliefs. You know, I mean, he's a very peaceful guy, and he was moved by the 9/11 attacks in the United States to become actively involved in reassessing the place of religion in our societies in this day and age. And I mean, it's just hypocritical, I think, for these religious groups, some of which are known to use intimidation and violence against their perceived enemies, to then come out against a peaceful atheist who just wants people to think a bit more deeply about everything. Mm.
It's the gall of them to, you know, these intolerant, hate-filled groups accuse others of intolerance and hate. It's
Exactly. They are the intolerant ones. Yes. And then they want to shut everybody else up. They do not want to tolerate anything that they don't
yes.
like.
Well, you might be guilty of some stuff here. Let me go on, because that was the Queensland Act. Now, it does include... So there's two parts to these sorts of laws, is what sort of action and to which sort of group. So that Queensland one, you can't ridicule religious groups. Now, the 18C is much broader in the things that you can't do. You can't offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate. But it doesn't include groups based on religion. So...
But that's incredibly broad.
It is incredibly broad, and religious groups want to be included in 18C. They want it to be an offence to offend, insult, humiliate, intimidate. So certainly those billboards would have offended, insulted, and humiliated the religious groups. Fortunately, religion isn't a category of group under 18C. So, but there's the danger of these provisions. And, you know, you mentioned before that Brandis was going to change 18C, but has backed away from
it. He publicly stated he was going to.
But
And in fact, he was undermined by Tony Abbott, as we know, when it was a result of some... was it as a result of the chocolate cafe scene?
I don't know.
I think it might have been part of the washout from that Abbott got cold feet. And in order to try and bring Muslim community leaders on side, you know, in a way of, keeping some eyes on certain individuals within their community, I think in order to get them on side, he basically... throughout the revision to 18C, and Brandis was hung out to dry on that one by his own Prime Minister.
I don't know the background of that. It wouldn't surprise me. Trying to follow the thought process of Tony Abbott is a difficult one, but I wrote a little piece called feel free to insult me, which is on the Secular Party forum. And goes over these things and gives my opinion of how the law should be changed. And I got the title, actually, Rowan Atkinson, the comedian, Mr. Bean. He's very big on this and has done some statements on YouTube.
On free speech, he is.
And basically saying in Britain that you should be allowed to insult people because, after all, it's a subjective thing. I mean, some people are so incredibly easily insulted that you can't operate without insulting some people.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And it appears to be the case in the United Kingdom, in France, Germany, and a number of other countries that we would have thought were basically secular democracies, that they are curtailing free speech at an alarming rate.
So that's the free speech done and dusted for the moment.
Okay.
Very briefly, tax talk at the moment is about possibly increasing the GST to 15%.
What do you think about that, Trevor?
I don't like it because it just means that poor people pay more tax compared to rich people as a percentage of their income.
That's right. That was always the argument against the GST, I think, wasn't it? Is that for rich people, if they pay another 10%, 15% on top of their goods, they're like, oh, gee, that wasn't very nice, was it? But for poorer people, it could make the difference between, you know, eating three times a day or only eating twice a day, or at least, you know, putting decent food on the table for families, etc.
It's regressive.
Having decent clothes on their kids when they go to school. And I know, as an ex-high school teacher, I used to see kids from some less well-off families come to school in pretty ratty tatty school uniforms, you know, that were obviously way beyond their use-by date. And you have to ask, how would an extra 5% on the GST affect people at the bottom of our community in terms of their economic status? And the answer is bleeding obvious, isn't it? It would have a very bad effect on them and very little effect on people who can afford everything.
Yeah, it's regressive, and we have become a less equal society in recent years, according to statistics. And I often look at things in America, and one of my motivations is I don't want Australia to end up like the United States of America in many respects. And one is their religiosity, and the other is their inequality. And we can't fall into that trap in Australia of having $7 an hour, you know, Coles workers and things like they have over there, and at McDonald's workers. I mean, people who need two jobs just to survive. So if you allow big business, then they will do that to you. They don't care. Their job is about profits for their shareholders. They don't care.
That's why
it really annoys me when I read things from the Business Council, who come out and say things like, the experience of other countries has shown that nothing will stimulate innovation and growth more than a reduction in the tax rate for all businesses.
Well, they've been saying that ever since Ronald Reagan, haven't they? And it's been shown quite clearly in the American case that the trickle-down theory was a complete myth, complete hoax, you know, just didn't work. They just kept more and more of it.
Of course they would say that.
There was apparently a rise in productivity in the United States during the, the 1980s and 90s, but they say that none of the increases in productivity went to the middle classes or the working classes, and that virtually all of it went to the richest top few percent. All the increases in productivity and profit went to the people who were already rich.
The middle class in the United States is basically disappearing before our eyes.
Yeah, it's being gutted. And, absolutely
and
gutted.
We can't have that here, and this sort of 15% GST is just one little step towards that. And I mean, the whole purpose,
that's right,
originally they talked about this massive budget deficit that we had, and we've got to fix it, and we need to collect more tax. But
Trevor, it was a budget emergency.
Yes, and so that's why we need to increase the GST. But then suddenly, well, if we're going to increase the GST, we need to reduce income tax. So I don't think it's going to happen, because I don't think they'll get the states to agree to it, and I don't think Scott Morrison can sell it, and I hope it doesn't happen.
Well, don't forget Scott Morrison is a member of the Hillsong Church too, isn't he? And you know what they preach at the Hillsong Church? The prosperity gospel, Trevor. That's what it's all about. In other words, it goes a sort of back to Calvinism, doesn't it? This idea that God picks and chooses who's going to have a good life. And if you're having a good life, it's a sure enough sign that God has chosen you. And if you're having a shitty life, well, that means for some reason, known only to God, you don't deserve to have a good life. So,
well, that would quote the Bible, that God helps those who help themselves. The problem is it doesn't. Yes, the problem is it doesn't say that in the Bible, but that would quote it anyway. But you know, again, this Business Council says we run the risk of undertaking a tax mix change that simply underwrites increased spending. Can't have that. But
spending by who?
You know, spending on who? You know, increased spending on somebody other than the business interests represented by the
spending on the leaners. I think the leaners and the bludgers.
So Scott Morrison has a thing to say in this article. Does he really think we're this stupid? He says that income tax had become the silent tax for many Australians, particularly young Australians. When they go to the ATM to draw out their cash, they do not see, as they do with the GST on their sales receipt, the 19 cents or 32.5 or 37 cents that they've just had deducted in income tax, let alone the 2 cents for Medicare levy. They just take the cash. Income tax has become too often out of sight and too often out of mind in comparison to the GST. Yet the tax you're paying is just as real and a lot higher. Does Scott Morrison really think that we're that stupid?
Yeah. Oh, I think he does, to be honest, Trevor. I think he sees most of the people who, you know, who are electors, who are voters, I think he sees them as basically easily swayed, you know, as mugs, as uneducated mugs who he can persuade to whichever point of view he wants. And look, you know, he's a typical politician, Scott Morrison, isn't he? Because he also just makes it up as he goes along. You know, he changes his tune according to what his agenda is at any given time.
I think he's been, you know, at the pulpit at the Hillsong far too often, watching people swallow anything and thinking that he can do the same thing with the Australian public.
Well, I don't think we should be surprised that he sees his political position as a kind of pulpit. And he's the, you know, boss evangelist in the government.
So, do you know what? I'm going to go back on my word, because we've got so much here. We're going to go another hour. And silently, my wife stuck her head through the door and looked at me with a look that said, like, what are you doing, still doing this podcast?
Are you still going?
So I reckon, Paul, we've got to hold some of this over till next time. Are you happy with that?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I've enjoyed it.
There wasn't anything you wanted to particularly get off your chest?
No, not in particular. I'm happy to just, you know, shoot at the mouth on any of these.
I can't
help
myself. I had one more little test for you that I didn't tell you about. Last week, you were talking about the voting age. And you and the Velvet Glove basically said, well, just didn't seem to be a compelling reason to change the voting age. And the Essential Report did a survey and asked people which of the following options would you favour. And it was A, keep the compulsory age at 18, B, reduce it to 16, C, reduce it to 16 but make it voluntary for 16 and 17 year olds, and D was don't know. Now, On the first one, keep the compulsory voting age at 18. How many percent do you reckon agreed with the notion of leaving it as it is?
I think about 70%.
You're very good, Paul. You're very good. 77%. The rest then aren't really worth looking at because they're just little bits of numbers. So,
yeah, that's what I assumed. I think most people didn't really take Bill Shorten's suggestion too seriously.
Yeah, it was so out of the blue and without any rationale by the looks of it. And just one more test for you. Knights, yes. Knights and okay. Dames, do you approve or disapprove of the government decision to stop awarding the honours of Knight and Dame?
I reckon it would have been over 80% approved stopping it.
Only 63.
Oh, 63% yes. Agreed that we should yes. get rid of them.
And
okay.
The don't knows was 23.
Okay.
I thought that was a really high figure of people. A quarter of the population didn't know whether we should get rid of yeah. knights or dames or not.
Yeah.
I would have thought that was an easy one to have an opinion about. So,
but don't you suspect, Scott, that there are a substantial number of people out there who really don't have an opinion on much of anything?
That's what we're trying to fix here at the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
These are the people whose lives are enriched by primetime TV and, Alan Jones on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. I thought that was a high number. But that's it. I've got a test in and I want to do that. So I've got to find some more between now and next week. So,
yes.
So, Paul, you've done admirably well as the 12th man. You've trotted onto the field. You've taken a few catches and performed a few runouts and saved a few runs. And you've done a great job. So, thank you for that. And
thank you for inviting me, Trevor. I've enjoyed it.
And we shall. We'll be back next week, folks, with another episode. And until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to I think $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.